11. I awoke just as the dropship touched down. Hyperion, I thought, still separating my thoughts from the tatters of dream. The young lieutenant wished us luck and was the first out as the door irised open and cool, thin air replaced the pressurized thickness of the cabin atmosphere. I followed Hunt out and down a standard docking ramp, through the shield wall and onto the tarmac. It was night, and I had no idea what the local time was. Whether the Terminator had just passed this point on the planet or was just approaching, but it felt and smelled late. It was raining softly. A light drizzle perfumed with the salt scent of the sea and the fresh hint of moistened vegetation. Field lights glared around the distant perimeter, and a score of lighted towers threw halos toward the low clouds. A half-dozen young men in marine field uniforms were quickly unloading the dropship, and I could see our young lieutenant speaking briskly to an officer 30 yards to our right. The small spaceport looked like something out of a history book, a colonial port from the earliest days of the Hegira. Primitive blast pits and landing squares stretched for a mile or more toward a dark bulk of hills to the north. Gantries and service towers tended to a score of military shuttles and small warcraft around us. And the landing areas were ringed by modular military buildings, sporting antennae arrays, violet containment fields, and a clutter of skimmers and aircraft. I followed Hunt's gaze and noticed a skimmer moving toward us. The blue and gold geodesic symbol of the hegemony on one of its skirts was illuminated by its running lights. Rain streaked the forward blisters and whipped away from the fans in a violent curtain of mist. The skimmer settled, a perspex blister split and folded, and a man stepped out and hurried across the tarmac toward us. He held out his hand to Hunt.
"M. Hunt? I'm Theo Lane."
Hunt shook the hand, nodded toward me.
"Pleased to meet you, Governor General. This is Joseph Severn."
I shook Lane's hand, a shock of recognition coming with the touch. I remembered Theo Lane through the déjà vu mists of the consul's memory, recalling the years when the young man was the vice-consul. Also from a brief meeting a week earlier when he greeted all of the pilgrims before they departed upriver on the levitation barge Benares. He seemed older than he had appeared just 6 days before, but the unruly lock of hair on his forehead was the same, as were the archaic eyeglasses he wore and the brisk, firm handshake.
"I'm pleased you could take the time to make planetfall," Governor General Lane said to Hunt. "I have several things I need to communicate to the CEO."
"That's why we're here," said Hunt.
He squinted up at the rain.
"We have about an hour. Is there somewhere we can dry off?"
The Governor General showed a youthful smile.
"The field here is a madhouse, even at 0520 hours, and the consulate is under siege. But I know a place."
He gestured toward the skimmer. As we lifted off, I noticed the two marine skimmers keeping pace with us, but I was still surprised that the governor-general of a protectorate world flew his own vehicle and did not have constant bodyguards. Then I remembered what the consul had told the other pilgrims about Theo Lane, about the young man's efficiency and self-effacing ways, and realized that such a low profile was in keeping with the diplomat's style. The sun rose as we lifted off from the spaceport and banked toward town. Low clouds glowed brilliantly as they were lighted from below. The hills to the north sparkled a bright green, violet, and russet, and the strip of sky below the clouds to the east was that heart-stopping green and lapis which I remembered from my dreams. Hyperion, I thought, and felt a thick tension and excitement catch in my throat. I leaned my head against the rain-streaked canopy and realized that some of the vertigo and confusion I felt at that moment came from a thinning of the background contact with the datasphere. The connection was still there, carried primarily on microwave and fatline channels now, but more tenuous than I had ever experienced. If the datasphere had been the sea in which I swam, I was now in shallow water indeed. Perhaps a tidal pool would be a better metaphor. And the water grew even shallower as we left the envelope of the spaceport and its crude microsphere.
I forced myself to pay attention to what Hunt and Governor General Lane were discussing.
"You can see the shacks and hovels," said Lane,
banking slightly so we had a better view of the hills and valleys separating the spaceport from the suburbs of the capital. Shacks and hovels were two polite terms for the miserable collection of fiber-plastic panels, patches of canvas, heaps of packing crates, and shards of flow foam that covered the hills and deep canyons. What obviously had once been a scenic 7 or 8 mile drive from the city to the spaceport through wooded hills now showed land stripped of all trees for firewood and shelter, meadows beaten to barren mudflats by the press of feet, and a city of 700,000 or 800,000 refugees sprawled over every flat piece of land in sight. Smoke from thousands of breakfast fires floated toward the clouds, and I could see movement everywhere. Children running in bare feet, women carrying water from streams that must be terribly polluted, men squatting in open fields and waiting in line at makeshift privies. I noted that high razor wire fences and violet containment field barriers had been set along both sides of the highway, and military checkpoints were visible every half mile. Long lines of force camouflaged ground vehicles and skimmers moved both directions along the highway and low-level flyways.
"Most of the refugees are indigenous," Governor General Lane was saying, "although there are thousands of displaced landowners from the southern cities and the large fiberplastic plantations on Aquila."
"Are they here because they think the ousters will invade?" asked Hunt.
Theo Lane glanced at Gladstone's aide.
"Originally there was panic at the thought of the Time Tombs opening," he said. "People were convinced that the Shrike was coming for them."
"Was it?" I asked. The young man shifted in his seat to look back at me.
"The 3rd Legion of the Self-Defense Force went north 7 months ago," he said. "It didn't come back."
"You said at first they were fleeing the Shrike," said Hunt. "Why did the others come?"
"They're waiting for the evacuation," said Lane. "Everyone knows what the ousters and the hegemony troops did to Brescia. They don't want to be here when that happens to Hyperion."
"You're aware that Force considers evacuation an absolute last resort," said Hunt.
"Yes, but we're not announcing that to the refugees. There have been terrible riots already. The Shrike Temple has been destroyed, a mob laid siege, and someone used shaped plasma charges stolen from the mine works on Ursus. Last week there were attacks on the consulate and the spaceport, as well as food riots in Jacktown."
Hunt nodded and watched the city approach. The buildings were low, few over 5 stories, and their white and pastel walls glowed richly in the slanting rays of morning light. I looked over Hunt's shoulder and saw the low mountain with the carved face of sad King Billy brooding over the valley. The Hooghly River twisted through the center of the old town, straightening before it headed northwest toward the unseen Bridal Range, twisting out of sight in the Werewood marshes to the southeast, where I knew it widened to its delta along the high main. The city looked uncrowded and peaceful after the sad confusion of the refugee slums. But even as we began to descend toward the river, I noticed the military traffic, the tanks and APCs and GAVs at intersections and sitting in parks, their camouflage polymer deliberately deactivated so the machines would look more threatening. Then I saw the refugees in the city, makeshift tents in the squares and alleys, thousands of sleeping forms along the curbs, like so many dull-colored bundles of laundry waiting to be picked up.
"Keats had a population of 200,000 2 years ago," said Governor General Lane. "Now, including the shack cities, we're nearing 3.5 million.
"I thought that there were fewer than 5 million people on the planet," said Hunt, "including indigenes."
"That's accurate," said Lane. "You see why everything's breaking down. The other 2 large cities, Port Romance and Endymion, are holding most of the rest of the refugees. Fiberplastic plantations on Aquila are empty, being reclaimed by the jungle and flame forests. The farm belts along the main and the Nine Tails aren't producing, or if they are, can't get their food to market because of the breakdown of the civilian transport system."
Hunt watched the river come closer.
"What is the government doing?"
Theo Lane smiled.
"You mean, what am I doing? Well, the crisis has been brewing for almost 3 years.
The first step was to dissolve the Home Rule Council and formally bring Hyperion into the Protectorate. Once I had executive powers, I moved to nationalize the remaining transit companies and dirigible lines. Only the military moves by skimmer here now, and to disband the Self-Defense Force.
Disband it? Said Hunt. I would think you would want to use it.
Governor General Lane shook his head. He touched the Omni-Control lightly, confidently, and the skimmer spiraled down toward the center of Old Keats.
They were worse than useless, he said. They were dangerous. I wasn't too upset when the Fighting Third Legion went north and just disappeared. As soon as the force, ground troops, and marines landed, I disarmed the rest of the SDF thugs. They were the source of most of the looting. Here's where we'll get some breakfast and talk.
The skimmer dropped in low over the river, circled a final time, and dropped lightly into the courtyard of an ancient structure made of stone and sticks and imaginatively designed windows. Cicero's. Even before Lane identified the place to Leigh Hunt, I recognized it from the Pilgrim's Passage. The old restaurant, pub, inn lay in the heart of Jacktown and sprawled over four buildings on 9 levels, its balconies and piers and darkened weirwood walkways overhanging the slow-moving Hooley on one side and the narrow lanes and alleys of Jacktown on the other. Cicero's was older than the stone face of sad King Billy, and its dim cubicles and deep wine cellars had been the true home of the consul during his years of exile here. Stan Lewesky met us at the courtyard door. Tall and massive, face as age-darkened and cracked as the stone walls of his inn, Lewesky was Cicero's, as had been his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather before him.
By damn,
declared the giant, clapping the governor-general, de facto dictator of this world, on his shoulders, hard enough to make Theo stagger.
You get up early for a change, huh? Bring your friends to breakfast? Welcome to Cicero's.
Stan Lewesky's huge hand swallowed Hunt's and then mine in a welcome that left me checking fingers and joints for damage.
Or is it later web time for you? He boomed. Maybe you like a drink or dinner.
Leigh Hunt squinted at the pub owner.
How did you know we were from the web?
Lewesky boomed a laugh that sent weather vanes on the roof line spinning.
Ha! Hard to deduct, yes? You come here with Theo at sunrise. You think he'd give everybody a ride here? Also wearing wool clothes when we got no sheeps here. You're not force people, and not fiber-plastic plantation big shots. I know all those. Ipso facto, you farcaster ships from the web drop down here for good food. Now you want breakfast or plenty to drink?
Theo Lane sighed. Give us a quiet corner, Stan. Bacon and eggs and brine kippers for me. Gentlemen?
Just coffee.
Yes, I said. We were following the owner through the corridors now, up short staircases and down wrought iron ramps, through more corridors. The place was lower, darker, smokier, and more fascinating than I remembered from my dreams. A few regulars looked up at us as we passed, but the place was far less crowded than I remembered. Obviously, Lane had sent troops to throw out the last of the SDF barbarians who had been occupying the place. We passed a high, narrow window, and I verified that hypothesis by catching a glimpse of a force-ground APC parked in the alley, troops lounging on and near it with obviously loaded weapons.
Here,
said Lewesky, waving us into a small porch which overhung the Hooley and looked out onto the gabled rooftops and stone towers of Jacktown.
Tommy be here in 2 minutes with your breakfast and coffees.
He disappeared quickly, for a giant. Hunt glanced at his comm log.
We have about 45 minutes before the dropship is supposed to return with us. Let's talk.
Lane nodded, removed his glasses and rubbed his eyes. I realized that he had been up all night, perhaps several nights.
Fine, he said, setting the glasses back in place.
What does CEO Gladstone want to know?
Hunt paused, while a very short man with parchment-white skin and yellow eyes brought our coffee in deep, thick mugs and set down a platter with Lane's food.
The CEO wants to know what you feel your priorities are, said Hunt. And she needs to know if you can hold out here if the fighting is prolonged.
Lane ate for a moment before responding. He took a long sip of coffee and stared intently at Hunt. It was real coffee, from the taste of it, better than most web-grown.
First question last, Lane said. Define prolonged.
Weeks.
Weeks? Probably. Months? No way.
The Governor General tried the brine kippers.
You see the state of our economy. If it wasn't for the supplies dropped in by force, we'd have food riots every day instead of once a week. There are no exports with the quarantine. Half the refugees want to find the Shrike temple priests and kill them. The other half want to convert before the Shrike finds them.
Have you found the priests? Asked Hunt.
No. We're sure they escaped the temple bombing, but the authorities can't locate them. Rumor has it they've gone north to Keep Kronos, a stone castle right above the high step where the time tombs are.
I knew better. At least I knew the pilgrims had not seen any Shrike temple priests during their brief stay in the keep. But there had been signs of a slaughter there.
As for our priorities, Theo Lane was saying, the first is evacuation. The second is elimination of the ouster threat. The third is help with the Shrike scare.
Lee Hunt sat back against oiled wood. Steam lifted from the heavy mug in his hands.
Evacuation is not a possibility at this time.
Why?
Lane fired the question like a hellwhip bolt.
CEO Gladstone does not have the political power. At this point, to convince the Senate and all thing that the web can accept 5 million refugees.
Bullshit, said the Governor General. There were twice that many tourists flooding Maui Covenant its first year in the Protectorate. And that destroyed a unique planetary ecology. Put us on Armagast or some desert world until the war scare is past.
Hunt shook his head. His basset hound eyes looked sadder than usual.
It isn't just the logistical question, he said. Or the political one, it's...
The Shrike, said Lane. He broke a piece of bacon. The Shrike is the real reason.
Yes, as well as fears of an ouster infiltration of the web.
The Governor General laughed.
So you're afraid that if you set up Farcaster portals here and let us out, a bunch of 3-meter ousters are going to land and get in line without anyone noticing?
Hunt sipped his coffee.
No, he said. But there is a real chance of an invasion. Every Farcaster portal is an opening to the web. The Advisory Council warns against it.
All right, said the younger man, his mouth half full. Evacuate us by ship, then. Wasn't that the reason for the original task force?
That was the ostensible reason, said Hunt. Our real goal now is to defeat the ousters and then bring Hyperion fully into the web.
And what about the Shrike threat then?
It will be neutralized, said Hunt.
He paused while a small group of men and women passed by our porch. I glanced up, started to return my attention to the table, and then snapped my head back around. The group had passed out of sight down the hallway. Wasn't that Emilio Arendez? I said, interrupting Governor General Lane.
What? Oh, Dr. Arendez. Yes, do you know him, M. Severn?
Lee Hunt was glaring at me, but I ignored it. Yes, I said to Lane, although I had never actually met Arendez.
What is he doing on Hyperion?
His team landed over 6 local months ago with a project proposal from Rijks University on Freeholm to do additional research on the time tombs.
But the time tombs were closed to research and tourists, I said.
Yes, but their instruments, we allowed data to be relayed weekly through the consulate Fatline transmitter, had already shown the change in the anti-entropic field surrounding the tombs. Rijks University knew the tombs were opening, if that's really what the change means, and they sent the top researchers in the web to study it.
But you did not grant them permission? I said. Theo Lane smiled without warmth.
CEO Gladstone did not grant them permission. The closure of the tombs is a direct order from TC Squared. If it were up to me, I would have denied the pilgrims' passage and allowed Dr. Arendez's team priority access.
He turned back to Hunt. Excuse me, I said, and slipped out of the booth. I found Arendez and his people, 3 women and 4 men, their clothing and physical styles suggesting different worlds in the web, 2 porches away. They were bent over their breakfasts and scientific comm logs, arguing in technical terms so abstruse as to leave a Talmudic scholar envious. "Dr. Arendez," I said.
"Yes?"
He looked up. He was 2 decades older than I remembered, entering middle age in his early 60s. But the strikingly handsome profile was the same, with the same bronzed skin, solid jaw, wavy black hair going only slightly gray at the temples, and piercing hazel eyes. I understood how a young female graduate student could have quickly fallen in love with him. "My name is Joseph Severn," I said. "You don't know me, but I knew a friend of yours, Rachel Weintraub." Arendez was on his feet in a second, offering apologies to the others, leading me by the elbow until we found an empty booth in a cubicle under a round window looking out on red-tiled rooftops. He released my elbow and appraised me carefully, taking in the web clothing. He turned my wrists over, looking for the telltale blueness of Poulsen treatments.
"You're too young," he said, "unless you knew Rachel as a child."
"Actually, it's her father I know best," I said. Dr. Arendez let out a breath and nodded.
"Of course,"
he said.
"Where is Saul? I've been trying to trace him for months through the consulate. The authorities on Hebron will only say that he's moved."
He gave me that appraising stare again.
"You knew about Rachel's illness?"
"Yes," I said. "The Merlin sickness, which had caused her to age backward, losing memories with each day and hour that passed. Emilio Arendez had been one of those memories. I know that you went to visit her about 15 standard years ago on Barnard's World." Arendez grimaced.
"That was a mistake,"
he said.
"I thought that I would talk to Saul and Sarai. When I saw her..."
He shook his head.
"Who are you? Do you know where Saul and Rachel are now? It's 3 days until her birthday."
I nodded. "Her first and last birthday." I glanced around. The hallway was silent and empty, except for a distant murmur of laughter from a lower level. "I'm here on a fact-finding trip from the CEO's office," I said. "I have information that Saul Weintraub and his daughter have traveled to the Time Tombs." Arendez looked as though I'd struck him in the solar plexus.
"Here? On Hyperion?"
He stared out at the rooftops for a moment.
"I should have realized. Although Saul always refused to return here, but with Sarai gone..."
He looked at me.
"Are you in touch with him? Is she... are they all right?"
I shook my head. "There are no radio or datasphere links with them at present," I said. "I know that they made the trip safely. The question is, what do you know? Your team, data on what is occurring at the Time Tombs might be very important to their survival." Emilio Arendez ran his hand through his hair.
"If only they'd let us go there. That damned stupid bureaucratic short-sightedness. You say you're from Gladstone's office. Can you explain to them why it's so important for us to get there?"
"I'm only a messenger," I said. "But tell me why it's so important, and I'll try to get the information to someone." Arendez's large hands cupped an invisible shape in midair. His tension and anger were palpable.
"For 3 years, the data was coming via telemetry and the squirts the consulate would allow once a week on their precious fatline transmitter. It showed a slow but relentless degradation of the antientropic envelope, the time tides, in and around the tombs. It was erratic, illogical, but steady. Our team was authorized to travel here shortly after the degradation began. We arrived about 6 months ago, saw data that suggested that the tombs were opening, coming into phase with now. But 4 days after we arrived, the instruments quit sending, all of them. We begged that bastard Lane to let us just go and recalibrate them, set up new sensors if he wouldn't let us investigate in person. Nothing. No transit permission, no communication with the university. Even with the coming of 4 ships to make it easier. We tried going upriver ourselves without permission, and some of Lane's marine goons intercepted us at Carla Locks and brought us back in handcuffs. I spent 4 weeks in jail. Now we're allowed to wander around Keats, but we'll be locked up indefinitely if we leave the city again."
Arendez leaned forward.
"Can you help?"
"I don't know," I said. "I want to help the Weintraubs. Perhaps it would be best if you could take your team to the site. Do you know when the tombs will open? The time physicist made an angry gesture.
If we had new data,
he sighed.
No, we don't know. They could be open already, or it could be another 6 months.
When you say open, I said, you don't mean physically open.
Of course not. The time tombs have been physically open for inspection since they were discovered 4 standard centuries ago. I mean open in the sense of dropping the time curtains that conceal parts of them, bringing the entire complex into phase with the local flow of time.
By local, you mean?
I mean in this universe, of course.
And you're sure that the tombs are moving backward in time, from our future? I asked.
Backward in time, yes, said Arendez. From our future, we can't say. We're not even sure what the future means in temporal physical terms. It could be a series of sine wave probabilities, or a decision branch megaverse, or even...
But whatever it is, I said, the time tombs and the Shrike are coming from there.
The time tombs for certain, said the physicist. I have no knowledge of the Shrike. My own guess is that it's a myth, fueled by the same hunger for superstitious verities that drives other religions.
Even after what happened to Rachel, I said, you still don't believe in the Shrike. Emilio Arendez glowered at me.
Rachel contracted Merlin's sickness, he said. It's an antientropic aging disease, not the bite of a mythical monster.
Time's bite has never been mythical, I said, surprising myself with such a cheap bit of homespun philosophy. The question is, will the Shrike or whatever power inhabits the time tombs return Rachel to the local time flow? Arendez nodded and turned his gaze to the rooftops. The sun had moved into the clouds and the morning was drab. The red tiles bleached of color. Rain was beginning to fall again. And the question is, I said, surprising myself again, are you still in love with her? The physicist turned his head slowly, fixing me in an angry gaze. I felt the retort, possibly physical, build, crest, and wane. He reached into his coat pocket and showed me a snapshot hollow of an attractive woman with graying hair and 2 children in their late teens.
My wife and children, said Emilio Arendez. They're waiting on Renaissance Vector.
He pointed a blunt finger at me.
If Rachel were cured today, I would be 82 standard years old before she again reached the age she was when we first met.
He lowered the finger, returned the hollow to his pocket.
And yes, he said, I'm still in love with her.
Ready?
The voice broke the silence a moment later. I looked up to see Hunt and Theo Lane in the doorway.
The dropship lifts off in 10 minutes, said Hunt.
I stood and shook hands with Emilio Arendez. I'll try, I said. Governor General Lane had one of his escort skimmers return us to the spaceport while he went back to the consulate. The military skimmer was no more comfortable than his consulate machine had been, but it was faster. We were strapped and fielded into our web seats aboard the dropship before Hunt said,
What was all that about with that physicist?
Just renewing old ties with a stranger, I said. Hunt frowned.
What did you promise him that you'd try?
I felt the dropship rumble, twitch, and then leap as the catapult grid launched us skyward. I told him I'd try to get him in to visit a sick friend, I said. Hunt continued to frown, but I pulled out a sketch pad and doodled images of Cicero's until we docked at the jump ship 15 minutes later. It was a shock to step through the Farcaster portal into the executive nexus in Government House. Another step took us to the Senate Gallery, where Mayna Gladstone was still speaking to a packed house. Imagers and microphones carried her speech to the All-Thing and 100 billion waiting citizens. I glanced at my chronometer. It was 1,038 hours. We had been gone. Only 90 minutes.